With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders Live. In this podcast, I ask a special guest to select and talk about the seven wonders of his or her world. This episode is one of several we recorded in front of a live audience at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival Fringe. In this particular recording, my guest is an always entertaining Scottish comedian who's been performing his stand-up shows in Edinburgh, usually in a kilt, on every fringe since the year 2000. So here we are with an enthusiastic Edinburgh Fringe audience exploring the seven wonders of Craig Hill.
Well done, Craig.
That's quite difficult.
Yes, you're sort of limboing in a kilt as well.
Oh, this is like... too close. I've never said that before.
Yeah.
That's. I shall cross my legs and see what happens. There you are. There are look at that woman. That's disgusting. There are consequences to crossing your legs in public in a kilt.
Oh, was it an up kilt shot she was taking?
No, she did that. She was, she was hoping for more than she's ever going to get.
Yes.
I'll say that.
Yeah. So Craig Hill, it's a memorable name. It does sound a bit like an address, doesn't it?
It's really funny. The taxi driver on the way here asked me if that was my real name.
Yes.
Which I thought was really strange because I think that's... I think my name is a little bit boring. It's just... it's a syllable. It's do. And I was thinking if I had to change my name, I would have... If I'd chosen a name for on stage, I would have chosen la la la. It would have had three syllables. I thought that would have been better.
Clive Anderson.
Hashtag little bit gel. Little bit jealous. When I was at drama college, they said, you know how in drama college they have to check if your name has been taken by anyone? And luckily, Craig Hill wasn't taken, other than the 1930s wonderful actor, Craig Hill, from many, many years ago.
Isn't there an American actor called Craig
Hill? Yeah. And old black and white movies.
Yes.
I'm assuming he's not around. But anyway, so
well,
no one...
Who I was trying to book today, but...
I'm sorry, is that wee Scottish guy? I didn't have to use it. But they said, I suddenly thought, well, you know how you have to come up with an alternative name just in case?
All right.
So weirdly, I mean, this is a very non-Scottish middle name that I have. So my name, I would have used my middle name, and my middle name is Carruthers. So I would have been Craig Carruthers. I would have been called that.
What about Carruthers Hill? That would have been.
He sounds richer than me, doesn't he?
He sounds like somebody could be in a Hitchcock movie.
He sounds like somebody who could be actually successful.
Yeah. Dr. Watson, played by Carruthers.
Yeah,
Hill.
I think if I, yeah, exactly. I think if I'd been an actor, I would have been quite a grand actor, played by Carruthers Hill.
Let's just move on to your title of your show, because you always have good titles for your shows.
Yeah, they're always cheeky double entendres.
Well, Jock's Trap, give him an inch. That was a good one. Playing with my selfie.
Well, I had a selfie. It was innocent. As long as you've got a selfie pic in the picture.
So what's your show called this year?
Well, I'll tell you, before I build up to that, I'll tell you a couple of my favourites. I don't know if the audience have been to see me before or not, but my favourite was Why Don't You Come Down the Front? Because people are always frightened to sit in the front because I engage with the audience so much. And I mean, it's perfectly innocent. And there was once, this was one of my favourite posters. I was in New York, and like Marilyn Monroe, I was winning a kilt, and the great actually lifted my kilt, and I thought, this is amazing. Mm. So we did a photo shoot of me wearing a white kilt with a white shirt, but we had to obviously, you know, have a fan in the photograph. And so I thought the fan made this title a lot more innocent, and the show was called Blown by a Fan, which I thought was really beautiful. But this year it's called... it's always innocent in my head. This is good. That's a good title.
Yes.
So this year my show is called I Always Knew I Had It In Me, because I did.
All right.
Because I always knew I was going to end up doing... Well, I don't know if I did, but I thought I was going to be a performer.
Yeah.
And I had a suspicion I might be homosexual.
And what's become of that suspicion? Is that...
It's confirmed. I've practiced and they've sent me an email and told me, yes, you passed.
So you went to drama college, what, with the intention of being an actor, or did you always want to be a comedian?
No, I went to drama college. Do you want to tell me my real reason for going to drama college? I was a hairdresser in Glasgow, and I thought students looked like they had more fun than anyone, and I was right. They have a fantastic life, and I just thought, I'd like to be a student, and I didn't know what to study.
Yeah.
So I went to this one-year course in Battlefield in Glasgow, first of all, in Langside College, and there was nursing, there was everything else, and then I saw this drama course, and I thought, oh, I used to act when I was younger, and I thought, oh, I'd quite like to do that again. So I did the drama course, and then I got into drama college.
So what age was that? You're a little bit older than...
Yeah, so I was a hairdresser from 17. I know it's hard to believe, it's kind of wasted with my hair, my non-hair. But 17 till 20, and then I went to this one-year course in Glasgow, and then I got into drama college in Edinburgh, which is why I've ended up living in Edinburgh for the last 30 years.
Oh, right. Oh, so you're not just here for the... Oh, I assume you just turn up for the Fringe.
That's what everyone thinks. No. I actually live in Edinburgh. I love the Fringe. I get so excited. But, well, because you come to me. Another good title.
Yes.
Oh, this show's writing itself. Somebody write this down. I'm going to use this tonight.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, one of the interviews I'm doing for BBC Radio 4, we've already done the interview, but it's on Saturday, is with Alan Cumming. So he's got a whole sequence of titles he could use.
Yes, he
to
has.
To upstage and, you.
And he does. Does he not have a kind of nightclub or something?
Yes.
It's a play on words as well, isn't it? I can't think what it's called.
Yeah, but. He has his dressing room, is called that. It's coming like the Cumming room or something.
Yeah, there's something a little bit cheeky.
Yes, a bit, that's, yes. You two should get together, but...
I did sing for him once.
Did you?
Yeah, he was doing... What was it called? He did it in the Hub during the Fringe, and it was after his show. It was like Late Night Cumming or something.
Yeah.
And I was in the audience. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, I was next to Tom Allen, because we were friends, and we were sitting in the audience, and somebody said, Alan Cumming was about to sing, and then he said, does anyone else sing? And some lesbian went, the wee gay guy does! And that lovely, broad Scots way. And I didn't really want to sing, he said. And then I got up and I sang. It was really lovely because I didn't know I was going to do it. And I'd had a couple of drinks and I sang a lovely song called The Nearness of You. Oh. And I sang it to Alan Cumming as he stood by the piano. And a builder videoed it. I don't know why a builder was interested in me, but he videoed some of it and he cut it off before the end. So I've got a little video of it, but I've never shared it. But it's a lovely moment. So yeah, I've met him. He's lovely.
Oh yeah, he's in his show called Burn. It was about Robert
Burns. I don't know how you feel, but see, when you're working in the Fringe, I get so jealous of you, punters, because you can go and see everything, and I find it hard to do that when you're so focused on your job.
Yeah.
You don't really have as much time as you think you have, or maybe we just drink
too much. That's a long speech which you use when somebody says, "Have you seen my show?" You say, oh, look, I'd love to have done
that.
My show's on at 7. What time is your show on?
My show's on at 7:15.
Yes.
That's quite a good time, actually, because I'm finished by 8:15.
Yeah.
So there are, I will go and see shows, not in the first week. You tend to just work on your show. So I think after that, I've already booked to go and see a couple of things already, so maybe things are in about 9 from then on.
Craig, it's been a joy talking to you. Unfortunately, we haven't had time to do any of your 7 wonders, so let's crack on with those. So your first...
I really thought you were going to wrap it up there. He's like, he's never going to shut up. He's a Scotsman.
No, this is good. So the first wonder that came to me on your list that you sent in, so because sometimes people have forgotten what they've sent in, so I'll remind you. The first one is cycling.
I know. Look at his face. His whole face was full of disdain. Like the taxi driver on the way here who said, I bloody hate cyclists. And I thought, well, I can't tell him I cycle because this girl came right out in front of us.
Right.
Now, it's interesting because, you know, the audience, I don't know if the audience really understand. You say 7 wonders, it sounds like I've disappointed you, doesn't it? Because it's not the Grand Canyon. But it's 7 things that I think make my life better.
Mm.
And cycling became a real passion for me because I used to, I think I'm a closet square. I think I'm actually quite boring underneath it all. And I used to live in Morningside in Edinburgh, and I realised there was a railway line that used to go all the way around Edinburgh, like a circular system.
All right.
And I thought, why didn't they keep that? That would have been fantastic. And then I realised most of it had been turned into cycle paths. That's cycle paths, psychopaths.
Yes.
And I started cycling around Edinburgh, and I suddenly thought, this is one of the most peaceful things I've ever done. And I, because I do a job which is kind of hyperactive, and I'm quite a hyperactive person, you wouldn't think I'm the kind of person who likes calm things, but I am. And I found the cycling was the noise pollution. It was lovely. There was no noise. There was no traffic. There was no cars coming towards you. It didn't feel dangerous. Mm. And it's all full of, you know, it's leafy. I mean, honestly, I think I'm a square and a hippie. And I really fell in love with cycling, specifically around Edinburgh at that time. And then I started cycling in other cities, and I suddenly realised you really could see much more than you could walking and public transport. When you, like in Berlin, I know Berlin quite well now because I've cycled all over it. Yeah. And I can really put that in London as well. I can really put the map together. So I like the perspective it gives you on the city, on the map, but also I like the physical perspective of the kind of raised perspective on a bike. Like, not, I don't do it in a race. I do it on a, I'm very Dutch. So, you know, I like the idea, like on a high bike. I just love the.
So you're a high up with a basket. No, yeah, you're not. I would have a racing bike. That
no. I would have a full length skirt if they would let me. I'd be like a proper Dutch girl. Yeah. You know, like I just think they look fantastic. But I know I like the idea of what you can see in the city, and I love the idea of being spontaneous and changing your mind at the last minute and suddenly finding a whole part of the city you didn't know. So I think it's the quickest way to get to know a city in a very short amount of time. But I've got another little interesting story I want to share with you. Mm-hmm. Now, this is exciting. I don't know how many people know Edinburgh this well, right? You love this. I even without knowing you that well, Clive, I think you'll like it. During lockdown, the bike, I think, saved my life because you know how you had that hour out the house and you had to go for a walk, and most people end up going for the same walk, and within 2 weeks you're really bored. So I suddenly thought, well, if you had the bike and you wrote down a list of places you wanted to go to in Edinburgh to explore them, you could, as long as it was 15 minutes cycle there, half an hour of photographs and taking it all in, then 15 minutes back, and then I would study it. So I found this book called 111 Things in Edinburgh You Shouldn't Miss.
Yeah.
And it was up. It changed my lockdown. I really loved lockdown because I had my bike. Yeah. And every day I wrote down a different place. And one of the most interesting things was I found out that Charles Dickens, when he was in Edinburgh, I think in the late 1800s, 1800s. Yeah, 1800s.
The 19th century.
Yeah, he was in Edinburgh. And I love this story. He was in the Canongate and he went to the graveyard, Canongate graveyard, and he saw a grave of a man from Fife called Ebenezer Lennox Scroggy.
Oh.
And it said on his grave, he was a mean man. And Charles Dickens wrote in his diary, what kind of life would somebody have had where you would actually have it engraved on your diary? He was a mean man. Yeah. And he misread it. It said he was a mealman. Yeah. And it's true. It's true. And Ebenezer Lennox Scroggy was a really kind corn merchant from, I think, Kirkcaldy, but he was from Fife. And I just loved that he was actually, that Charles Dickens, nobody would know that, the Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge is a man from Fife. Yeah. I just love that. So that's what I loved about cycling.
Well, that's a very good story. But Dickens spent a lot of time trying to think of the right names for people.
Yeah, and I tried to find that grave, but I think in 1938, they didn't know it was special. Oh. So they dug up that graveyard, and that grave doesn't exist. But the story does, and because Charles Dickens wrote it in his diary, you know it's true.
Yeah.
So that was the thing was, the cycling, I think, saved me during lockdown because it gave me an adventure.
Mm. Well, I'm not sneering at cycling. It's obviously a very good thing to do. Just I've had some unhappy experiences in cycling, and this is cycling
as a cyclist.
As a cyclist, yes. So I had quite a bad accident when I was 11. But I cycled on afterwards, so it wasn't, you know, it didn't end my cycling. And it just so happens I've left home. I'm away from home at the moment from London, and in quick succession, there's been a murder just just down the road from where I am. It's all in the news, a 15-year-old boy being stabbed to death.
Oh, no.
And there's been a big flood because of main water main bursting. And my wife's coping with all this, and then she found, oh, she had her bicycle stolen. So she's got one of these Brompton bikes. She doesn't use it that often, but she cycled it to the British Museum of all places, chained it up with.
I love that. British Museum places.
Well, I don't know. People.
I think there'd be a decent sort at the door there.
Yeah, you thought people would see what's going on to steal it.
Yeah,
you
have
to
bring those. It's a bit too visible, isn't it?
But why don't people intervene and say, well, you know, what are you doing there? You can't.
Work. Maybe they thought it was their bike. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't obvious. But yeah, I'm always worried that someone's going to steal my bike. And it's funny, isn't it? You wouldn't think something is. And do this sounds really weird. Even in New York, I went to New York and my friend said, you did not cycle around New York. And I said, I did. I wanted to go to Williamsburg. I wanted to go to the Bronx. Right. And I just thought it was easier than anything else. And the thing that surprised me about New York is it's actually better designed for cycling than you would imagine. So all the way from, what's it called? Hell's Kitchen, all the way down to, what's it called? The I don't know, it's the Hudson, really, but all the way down. Yeah. That's a cycle path all the way, and it's completely separate from the road, so it's right. not dangerous. Okay. And the other thing is, if you are on Fifth Avenue, the thing that surprised me is it's all one way, so there's no one coming towards you. I'd never noticed that before until I was on the bike, and I thought, I can't believe I feel safe on a bike in New York. So, yeah, so that's one of my wonders. I think it's one of my joys in life that's happened later to me in life.
Cycling, very good. And I was just going to say, but Edinburgh doesn't strike me as the best city for cycling.
I used to never cycle
in
Edinburgh.
The hill, the cobbles.
Yeah, so I saved my cycling for other cities. I didn't really do it in Edinburgh. I did it in Lisbon or Porto or anywhere. I love hiring a bike. Even in the UK, I was in Nottingham a couple of weeks ago, and the first thing I did was hire a bike.
Yes.
And, I love the canal. People don't really think of Edinburgh having a canal, but the canal system in Edinburgh is lovely, and it goes all the way to Glasgow. And then I think between Bath and Bristol, there's a beautiful... Anywhere cycling on a canal is just... Yeah. It's an absolute joy. I feel
until
like,
you fall in. If somebody
until said, you fall in. But, cycle safely and don't be an idiot. My goodness, don't fall in the water.
Okay, all right, cycling. Cycling's very good. Now we'll go on to your next wonder, which is Google Maps.
I know this sounds really boring, doesn't it? This is the part of me that's really square. Now, this is... I'll tell you how this started. I was in Reykjavik with my friend who was Icelandic, and we went for a coffee, and she said, it was really nice to see you, but that was the worst coffee I've ever had. And we went around the corner, and there was a wee coffee shop with busted sofas, with homemade scones, with this lovely couple who were so happy that we came there, nice independent business. And they were playing Dolly Parton on a record player, my kind of thing. And I said to her, I've had an epiphany. I said, I'm never going to waste a coffee ever again. I've just realised I have 6 nights in Reykjavik, and I've got 6 drinks, 6 lunches, 6 dinners. And if I go in, if any of them are bad, it's my fault. It's because I've not done the research. So I started looking on Google Maps in advance of going places, as if I was flying above the place. I often go to bed at night choosing a city of my choice. And I'll start to future choose. I don't even know that's an expression. And I didn't realise if you like a place or find a place or someone recommends a place, you can save it on your favourites. And it's a love heart. So I have a love heart list all over the world now. And it's an absolute joy. And now I get more excited about doing comedy in other cities like... Do you know, like I know when I go to, is it Birmingham? There's a place called, I don't know, it's called York's. Anyway, I get more excited about going to places for breakfast and lunch and dinner you can't do because you're doing stand-up comedy, or bars as well. So I save, and I notice that when people go on holiday and they often say, we went to whatever, Brazil, for the life of them, they can't remember the name of the restaurant or where they went. So the reason I love Google Maps is it's allowed me to save... I could almost do a travel blog now. All my favourite places I've either been to or want to go to or have recommended or read about.
Yeah.
And just the whole idea that when we were travelling around Scotland, you know, when you were first allowed out in Scotland, we didn't go abroad, during lockdown. I was able to look at viewpoints in advance, and when we were traveling over, thinking, actually, this is just, imagine having all this information at your fingertips, viewpoints, waterfalls, castles. So I thought, go Google Maps, because in the old days, you would have to have had quite a good general knowledge of where everything was, or be patient with a big map. And I think it's quite liberating, this unbelievable amount of information, what something looks like, how much something costs, what the menu is. I find it liberating.
Using more than just some people might do, and I say some people, I mean me, just might use Google Maps just to get from A to B. Make a note of the place or give it a rating, or because you've got to keep updating it, because if you went back to Reykjavik in 5 years' time, somebody may have taken over that.
No, but it's great fun, because loads of friends say to me, I'm going to Lisbon, can you send me your love heart list? And I go, and you can actually send it to people. So look, everyone's wanting it now. But it's quite good fun. I like it when somebody tells me where they live, and I go, have you been to that restaurant? They go, how do you know about that restaurant? They only opened 2 weeks ago. Well, that's what it is. Well, love heartless, Google Maps.
Well, I think this is inspiring. I thought it was a slightly narrow, because, Google Maps is all part of smartphones and Apples and you know, all the various bits. We now carry around on our phone more computer power than it took to go to the moon or whatever.
I remember when I started stand-up comedy, I thought the iPhone was built for me, because I remember doing gigs in London and thinking, right, I had to take an iPod to play music on stage. I had to take an A4 sheet of the things I'd written down that I was doing, my set list. I had to take a map to get to the place. I had to take, an organizer, like an iPack, I think it was called, with all the information of who I had to speak to. And suddenly somebody invented the iPhone. I thought, wow, this is from a comedian's point of view, that's everything on one thing. So, but it was the Google Maps that stood out to me. So initially that sounds like a really square, boring choice, doesn't it? It sounds like,
it's an inspiring choice. It's very good. But along the way, you've mentioned about, you perform here, perform there. So you've mentioned a variety of English speaking places, but do you also appear in non-English speaking cities?
You would be surprised. The president of Estonia said that I was his second favourite comedian, and I didn't have the heart to ask who the first was.
He's probably some diplomatic reason he has to name an Estonian comedian.
You wouldn't imagine when you do something like stand-up comedy. I would never have imagined it would have allowed me to travel the way it does. And we went and did this tour, and anything ended in Enia or Onia. I think we went to Bulgaria, we went to Estonia, we went to Transylvania, the home of the Cheeky Girls, and we played in a football stadium, and someone from my hometown was there. I mean, I thought, God, this world's bizarre. Yeah. It's such a fascinating job to do for a living. But yeah, and because I slow things down, because when I'm doing the Edinburgh Fringe, I think, I don't know if anyone's seen me before, but I'm very indulgently Scottish, and I use a lot of Scottish language, and I think it's funny, I love Scottish language, but yeah, when I tour, when I go to Australia, for example, I have to really modify it. So,
all right.
So yeah, it's exciting. Yeah. You know, gigs in Kuala Lumpur and Singapore. I mean,
expats coming in the way?
Yeah,
Andy Stewart used to do those gigs in the old days.
Very specifically expats. Yeah, that's women who used to be called Patricia. But yeah, expat gigs. Yeah, so they're quite fun. That's why But in Bulgaria, for example, like, you know, you go there thinking, how on earth is this going to go down? And it was me and a guy called Jimmy McGee, ironically, a very English comedian with a very Scottish name.
Yes.
And me and him. And now what's interesting about Bulgaria, I think it was Sofia, the audience are all 26. They're all young, 26 or under, because their English is so sophisticated that they actually understand the structure of a joke. Uh-huh. And I think they're very proud of themselves for having such a good knowledge. Because it's one thing speaking English. Yeah, it's another thing having the knowledge of a joke and why that's funny.
And you might get a bit of a boost there because the way people do in England or in Scotland when there's a foreign language film on, some people laugh very loudly. Say, oh, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, pretending to laugh.
They're all laughing at you, going, oh, I bet that's funny.
What was interesting was they treated you like a rock star because it was so exciting that you'd come all the way from the UK or from Scotland, and especially with me wearing my kilt. It was a wee novelty. I don't think they'd particularly seen that. So, yeah, it's quite good fun. That's the lovely part of my job.
And they enjoyed seeing your wee novelty anyway. So
it's not a wee novelty. That woman knows.
All right. Google Maps, surprisingly interesting wonder, I would say. But the next one is perhaps more relatable to more people in the world, singing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I almost forgot what the next one was going to be. I was just trying to list things that give you joy in life. And I'm always really curious. I don't know if you can sing or not. I'm always really curious. If you sing and the noise that comes out isn't pleasant, would you get the same joy from it? Because the reason I love singing is because I like the way it sounds. Mm-hmm. So if I start singing and, you know, I'll be like, oh, it makes me feel like I'm letting go of something. And it always has.
What sort of singing do you like doing? Do you sing in church? Are you a pop singer? Are you operatic if you had a chance?
No, when I first started stand-up comedy, I used to do Julie Andrews sings punk songs. And then I used to do Shirley Bassey sings The Smiths. Because that's what made my friends laugh. And I was always someone who loves singing. And I used to be in bands when I was younger. And it's funny because someone once asked me, if you had the choice between losing your ability to be funny, which one assumes one has, or your ability to sing, which one would you choose? And I said, I couldn't lose the ability to sing, which is really strange given my job. But it gives me so much joy. I think it's a real passion. And sometimes I'll just phone up my friends and say, do you mind if I sing to you? How cheesy is that? But yeah, the kind of stuff for example, when I was young, I don't know how we were exposed to this. And I come from East Kilbride, a kind of new town outside Glasgow.
Hear of West Kilbride, do you?
Well, it's funny because I did a gig the other week, and this guy, I said, is anyone from East Kilbride? And this guy said, I'm from West Kilbride. And I pretended to care.
Yeah.
And it wasn't what I asked.
Yeah.
But for some reason, growing up on East Kilbride, we listened to Motown. I don't know how on earth I was exposed. And one of my favourite songs was a Christmas in Motown. Really bizarre lyrics by Stevie Wonder. And what was it he used to sing? I'm trying to think of it. One day at Christmas, men will be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. What the hell? That's the lyrics of that song. But it was so beautiful. Yeah. And I think I was exposed to, and because I had a big family, so my one brother would listen to Motown, one brother would listen to The Smiths, my mum listened to Philomena Begley, an Irish singer, and then somebody else would listen to Slade. So I was exposed to a lot of music when I was young. But the ones that stuck with me were Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Barbara Streisand, because I'm gay, and Shirley Bassey. So anyone who could really sing. Yeah. And I remember Barbara Streisand was interviewed once, and they asked her, like, they said, because she didn't train as a singer, which is amazing given her beautiful voices. And they said, how can you sing like that? And she answered really simply. She said, because I want to. And I thought, that's a really good answer. That's how I would how I would describe my love of singing. Yeah. It's just a desire to, I don't even care if anyone's there. I was about to go into too much detail. Let's just say I met somebody once who said, why do I get the impression if I wasn't here, you'd still be doing that? And I said, because I would be. So I was singing.
We're still talking about singing, are we?
No, yes, I was singing in an environment. Yes.
What about you?
After someone special.
You said Julie Andrews doing punk songs.
I'm not going to do it.
Do that now.
Such
okay,
a long okay. time. Yeah. No, but I used to have this thing where I was obsessed with, because I suddenly noticed that Julie sang in a very English accent, and she always sounded like she had never had sex. She had this lovely innocence about her in her voice, and so I would kind of impersonated her as a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a proper impersonation. It was just for fun. But yeah, so singing has just been a passion for me for years. I think I'll do that for you. Even when it stops to sound pleasant, I'll continue.
Well, I wouldn't claim to have a good singing voice, but every now and then people say, well, you're Seven Wonders. And every now and then I slot in music as a wonder.
Listen to or to sing?
Well, just because I introduce a lot of musicians, I meet a lot of musicians, but I don't really understand how music works. My musical education stayed about the level of a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old. So I'm the equivalent of a sort of going through school and being illiterate at the end of it. And then you're surrounded by writing and reading. You never get. So music for me is in that category. So for me, that it makes it a wonder. So it's not because I think it's something I can do, but I wonder at people's ability to affect my emotions with music.
Absolutely right to be mesmerized by that, because that is amazing, isn't it? You think, how could they know me the way they know me through that song? Yeah. And I used to be in a band, lots of different bands, but my favorite band was me and one particular guy, and we used to write our own songs. And that improvisation, that idea where somebody picks up a guitar and you sing whatever comes into your head, that for me is the greatest joy. Yeah. And I've recently, he's actually coming to see my show tonight.
Right.
I've recently got back together with him, and I've decided that I'd love to do that purely for the passion of doing it. I mean, I'd like to write, and I don't even know if it would matter too much if anyone particularly enjoyed it. I would do it for the joy of it.
So what was your band? I hope he was called Dale. So
we were called Desmond, actually.
Desmond. I'm going to have you as Hill and Dale or something.
Hill and Dale. Okay. No.
Hill or something.
I think we were called Desmond because that was our favourite sitcom in the 80s. Remember that sitcom?
The Desmonds.
Yes. It was set in a hairdresser.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The hairdresser. But
So I think we just thought it was a kind of cool name. So we did it. So,
okay. All right. Well, singing. But singing is a sort of a joy to you to hear other people singing yourself, but it's also a little bit in your profession.
It is listening to other people, but it's much more the joy
doing it yourself.
of what it makes you feel like. Yeah. I can't believe, I don't know if everyone can relate to that, but I can't believe what it makes you feel like. It's so expressive. Yeah. I really love it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're going to go on to your next wonder, which is planes.
Aeroplanes. I know, this sounds... I think I'm a square. A plane sounds like a really boring one as well, but I think it's because when I was... I was a hairdresser in the 80s and I was on a YTS, a youth training scheme, and I never had any money. I was always so skint. Do you know, I remember, of course, you don't really get much money when you're a hairdresser. And then I was an actor. They're paid well. Mm. And I remember being unemployed and not having much money and sometimes working, sometimes not working. And so I was obsessed with wanting to travel and I never thought I would get to travel. Mm. And I wasn't on a plane till I was 26. Mm. And I went to Mykonos and it was like, I mean, it sounds really weird, going to another world. It was going to another world. It was Greece. And it was the most exhilarating thing I'd ever done. Mm. And for some reason, when I first went to Europe, I expected it all to look like England or Scotland or Wales. And it was so exciting to see what other countries looked like and discover their cultures. And I think I feel really privileged to have grown up in a generation where we can afford to travel, because I don't think my parents' generation would have been able to do that. I think in the 70s it was expensive to travel and only people with a wee bit of money could travel, or it was a big treat. Yeah. So I think travel has been the great joy of my life. So it's maybe not specifically being in planes, but it's traveling. And planes, I said specifically because it's traveling to other countries that I find the most stimulating. And I think what a world that we live in, that we can see. And I'm very lucky because I didn't know stand-up comedy would take... I didn't try to do stand-up comedy. I didn't know I was going to do it. One of my friends phoned the Gilded Balloon 24 years ago and booked a gig for me without telling me.
Gilded Balloon here?
Yeah, and that's how I started. She phoned the Gilded Balloon and said, "I think my friend's funny." Yeah. And then she told me and I didn't know anything about it. And I said, "What will I do?" She went, "I don't know. The rest is up to you."
So how long did you do in that first...
I did 4 minutes.
4 minutes?
Yeah.
Well, that can be a long 4 minutes if you've not done it before.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember...
Can you remember your first gag or anything like that?
Yeah. I did Julie Andrews singing pop songs straight away.
Yes.
Because I thought, I have to do what makes my friends laugh, and they always laughed at that. And it was quite interesting because I remember the first guy going on, it was two guys before me, and they didn't really get much, and then I didn't get anything. And then instead of making me nervous, I just thought, well, if I don't get anything, then I'm just the same, that's fine. And then I got something. And I thought, I don't know if anyone has ever tried to do stand-up comedy. It's quite weird to talk about now because it's my job, but at the time, it was the scariest thing you could ever imagine doing, but the most excited I'd ever been in my whole life. And I thought, I think you should do things that scare you from now on, and that's why I started doing stand-up comedy. But I never would have imagined it would have allowed me to travel to Australia to stand on Sydney Harbour Bridge, and I just thought, God, my granddad would never believe I got to do this. So I think I just feel very lucky to have travelled so much with a fun job.
Come back to the travel for me, but that's talking about doing stand up comedy, coming on after somebody else. There's a sort of perfect amount of a response that the person before you should get. I mean, if it's completely dead and the audience is really annoyed, then that's not great because you've got to start. But if they're absolutely storming it, oh, God, he's fantastic. Oh, now you on.
It's funny because you really have that. I find that I'm glad you asked that question because it's psychologically, that's a really interesting game you play with yourself. So I try not to be too involved in the gig before I come on because you can't.
Yeah.
You can't really get your head into that space. So if I'm ever speaking to a young comedian who's nervous, I always say, you're not going into their world. They're coming into yours. So don't Don't ever apologize for your world. Don't half do your world. You can only be the comedian you are. And if they don't like it, they don't like it. But it better not be because you didn't commit. Yes. So I just think relax and do what you do. And some people will like it and some people won't. And that's fine. So
anyway, but going back to planes, so that it's the opportunity to go to other places. I've got a golden age that is perhaps coming to an end now.
People are much more environmentally aware about what they should be doing that as well.
But you remember that. So you were 26 and you're first on a plane. I was only a bit younger. I was about 15, I think, when I went on my first plane journey.
Oh, really?
And the thing I always think about when the planes take off, I was thinking how exciting it was, that first journey. I was only flying from London to Paris.
So yeah.
It wasn't exactly going to
the end.
But it was that thing of getting faster and faster and faster. And then for some reason, a plane gets off the ground. I know what the science is, but it doesn't make sense.
You're right. We should be shocked by that every time it happens. I mean, and what a privileged perspective. I remember flying to Australia, and there's something about long-haul flying that makes you really emotional.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the alcohol. Yeah. But you know how,
maybe
like...
it's the film you're watching.
Film you're watching. But you know, there's something about being stuck in a plane for 13 hours, and I find it really therapeutic. I mean, how many times in life could you get away with doing absolutely nothing for 13 hours? And there's something about that privileged perspective over the clouds. You think, somebody invented something that made this happen. Yeah. And I'm grateful for it, because we would never see that if somebody clever hadn't made that happen.
Do you know that astonishing statistic? If you say, how long is it? Maybe some of the audience will know this, even if you may or may not. How many years are there between the Wright brothers doing their first flight and flying to the moon, the flight to the moon? How many years?
Well, I'm going to guess, why do I think it was 1913 to 1969? So I'm going to guess it's, I don't know why I've got 1930 in my head. I've got to do math now, haven't I? 13 is your actual 56?
Yeah. The math is getting right, but the answer's wrong. Does anyone
56,
have
no,
it's a good pub
56
quiz.
56 years?
50 is near, you're not quite right, but it's close enough. It's 66 years, which is an astonishingly short time from nobody being able to fly to being able to fly to the moon.
It is, flying heavy, big, and heavy, big objects like rockets.
Yes. And as you say, you can fly on a huge plane all the way around the world to Australia.
And I think airports, have that. There's a positivity about, not at the moment, because some people get there and get told to go home. But, there's that kind of sense of, again, they're emotional. You're either meeting people or saying goodbye to people, or you're going on an adventure. And that sense of promise, I think that's what I like about flying.
Richard Curtis's idea of, with that film, when it's not forwarding the funeral. What's the one? Love Actually. Yes,
Love Actually.
Love Actually, because it's all the happy meetings at airport. But is it now, if you think about journeys, especially, let's say, a sort of journey you're talking about, going to Greece, you've got to factor in the 2 hours to get to the airport, the 3 hours to queue at the airport, having you take all your belt off and be inspected. And you have to forget all that for the next time you want to go away, because you wouldn't do it. It's a bit like childbirth. You forget all the nastiness for the benefit that comes later.
I'm sure it's exactly like childbirth. Yeah.
Well, we're exactly the two people should be discussing it.
But I am that kind of person who sits on the tram on the way to the airport, who's already untying the shoes, already taking the belt off, not in public, but in putting in my bag, because I try to make it as stressless as possible, because it is potentially stressful.
I try to
disappear. If I'm getting on at gate 7, I'm at gate 5. I don't want to be. I find it quite peaceful. I want to.
Does
escape
that mean you fly to the wrong places?
No, it means I'm the last person on the plane. I try to be the last person on the plane, because I just want it to be calm.
Oh, but all that sort of queuing, people stand
I can't be bothered.
Stand
with
up
the queuing
as the plane is landing.
No, I can't be bothered.
Why do you want to stand there for 10 minutes?
It's too stressful.
Why do you want to queue up before
you've
got a
once,
named seat? It doesn't.
You've
matter.
Just reminded me. Me and my friend, we always play this kind of let's be the last person on the plane, and we're watching other people thinking, God, they look quite stressed. I wouldn't be standing in that queue for 40 minutes. And one time I said, oh, let's, I don't even care if we sit together. It doesn't matter. As long as we just get on the plane, we don't have to do all the queuing. And we watched people getting stressed, going, excuse me, I paid for speedy boarding, getting themselves stressed. And I thought, oh, don't do that. And we watched them. And at the very last minute, we were the last people on the plane. And it turns out we weren't getting on the plane. We were getting on the bus, which meant we were the first people on the plane. And they hated us. I've never felt more guilty in my life. Yeah. We sat in seats one and two, and I said, I can't even look at them. I can't even look at them when they come in. I was mortified.
So it's the journey you like, and the planes provide that, rather than necessarily an
interview. It's not necessarily like an obsession.
Would you know anything about the plane?
No. I wouldn't be like a plane spotter. I wouldn't be like somebody who would know, well, that's an A16. Mm. I just made that up.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know that. I'm not obsessive like that, but it's more what they do for you.
Okay. All right. Well, but again, it's a wonder. I can see they are wonderful things. They're slightly incomprehensible. Just a slight difference in shape of the top and bottom of the wing means you can fly to Australia. Seems unlikely.
It does.
But it seems to work. I think everyone on the plane has to believe that flying works. If the majority of people on the plane don't believe it anymore, that's when you have plane crashes. So that's
why? Because
that's
they willed it to use it?
Yes, it's in some way, because it doesn't make sense otherwise.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, how you're able to relax in that situation. When if you stop to think about it would overwhelm you.
Yeah. All right. Now, your next wonder is...
Oh, look at your face. I can see your face already.
It's a puzzler. It's lists.
Yeah, lists. This, again. I'm much more boring than you would imagine. Well, it's interesting. The reason I wrote lists is... Again, during lockdown, I spoke to lots of people who, you know, some people found it really difficult. Some people who'd never had to create structure in their lives before suddenly didn't know what to do with free time. Mm. And I think creating structure is really important. I think it's good for your mental health in that sense of... knowing what you want to do with your day, especially when you're given lockdown and there was nothing to do with your day. So you basically had to practice control over your life. You had to create structure yourself. And I've always been a bit of a kind of listy person. Like, I'm actually embarrassed by my lists. Like, my phone has alerts that go off and my friend goes, oh, what's that? Is that bins out? And it is.
Yeah.
And I'd be embarrassed to show someone how listed my life is. Mm. So, no, I think it's to do with doing stand-up comedy. It's to do with I've never had a normal job.
Yeah.
So I've not had to be... Well, I mean, you know, I've not had a Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, had to go to a place. Mm. So I learned as a comedian that I had to create structure myself. Yeah. So I think the sense of achievement when you get through the things you want to do. And I think if I didn't do that, everything would take longer and I'd feel a little bit lost and I'd be behind and everything. I think my life would be stressful without lists. Yeah. Some people would find lists stressful. But when I'm on holiday, I'll have a rough list of things I want to do. I mean, you know, my friends are going, we don't have to do everything on the list. and I'll allow myself to be spontaneous. Mm. But I find lists quite therapeutic. I find the idea of going through them. And also as a comedian, if you think about it, when you have a show and you've written all these pieces of material and you put them all together, you're trying to connect them to make them into a story. And when I'm on stage, this is a kind of weird thing to reveal to an audience, but I can see the A4 sheet while I'm chatting to the audience and I'm editing while I'm talking.
Oh, that's brilliant. And see the list in your mind.
I can see the list. Yeah. It's like a photographic thing. And I know, for example, in my show at the moment, I know You'll Never Be Lonely, A Bus Stop in Glasgow is down there, and Elvis Presswick is up there about Elvis landing in Prestwick. So I know that, so lists are really important for me to know what I'm doing. Physical lists as a set list, but also just day to day. I like having a realistic idea of how long it takes you to get anywhere. I think I spend my whole life trying to make sure your life isn't stressful, and that's the lists actually help.
So do you have a to-do list? You know, this today or during the course of this Saturday, I've got to put the bins out. I've got to water such and such.
It does say in my phone today, water plants. I mean, it does because I've got a garden and I'm away quite a lot. And I think if I think I'm one of these people, if I don't write things down, I don't do them.
Yeah.
And I've learned that over the years. So, and sometimes there'll be, most of the time I would probably remember the list. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But I think again, it's to do with technology. It's the phone and it's the calendar. So the list is mainly in there with alerts and stuff.
It's interesting. You put that on. I asked you to produce a list of seven wonders. And in the course of producing that list, you listed list as,
yes,
as a wonder.
I did.
Yes,
I did. And what was really funny, before I came here, I rewrote that list from a typed list to a handwritten list.
Yes.
Because I thought, well, if Clive asked me, I'm going to have to prompt myself to remember why I chose these. So I think there's something psychological about things go in your head and they stay in your head more. And I think as a comedian, I think you learn your script and your lines by sometimes, you know, like some people say, why would you hand write a set list after all these years when you could type it out? And I think it's because you remember the structure of your jokes and your lines more. So I think lists maybe specifically to comedians are quite important.
Well, the only thing equivalent I would have, it's not really for me to talk about me, but so when I often interview people and they've published a book, so I can only do that. The way I have to do it really is I read the book and I make a note every now and then in the book of interesting things, and I make the note of the page number. Afterwards, I then have to type out all the page numbers and write a word or two about each of those things. And I almost never look at that list when I'm interviewing the person.
Yeah.
That process of putting it fixes. Otherwise, I could read a book and I'd come think, oh, God, yeah, I read your book. I can't remember a damn thing about it. But well, that process.
But that's interesting, because if you concentrate too much on the list, you lose the ability to be free and communicate. So it's like when you're on stage, I'll sometimes, for the first few nights, I used to have a set list that was kind of hidden, but it was there somewhere. And then I realised I never had the chance to look at it anyway.
But it's a comfort blanket as well,
though,
to know it's there.
So it's just there. So if you ever kind of thought, oh my God, what was that thing about Elvis and the press, but you could see it. But most times you can't really see it.
Is it sometimes, though, putting off the work? I'm going right back to school days. The thing that
I'm definitely that person.
The revision, the revision time. Well, first of all, we're still a revision plan.
Yes, that's exactly the kind of person I'm. But it does work for me, because I'm more likely to do it if I structured it.
But you spent 2 hours drawing up a plan. You could have spent 2 hours.
My friend said exactly. He said you would spend more time writing the list of things to do, you'd never get around to things to do. But that isn't what happens now. I think I get more done by having things listed.
Yes.
Like all the things you can't do during the fringe in your house. You know, all those things you think, oh my God, I've got a whole pile of stuff that I need to, you know, things that need to be framed and put on walls and things that are just little boring chores.
Okay, we've done lists. This having to go through seven gifts is a list, and we're following it, and it's demonstrating
well done,
the use of it. So the sixth list is going out for breakfast.
I know, again, sounds really boring, but from a comedian's point of view, the one thing we don't get to do when we travel is go out for dinner. Well, I mean, I do in my normal life. This isn't normal life. But you know, like when you're working, in the evenings quite a lot. So I've had to change my joy. My joy has had to become breakfast. And I think when you're in another city, like if you're in Nottingham or, Leeds or whatever, Birmingham, you've got your gig in the evening and you've got your little routine kind of mid-afternoon. And I see people going out to pubs and I see them all, you know, they have fun in the same time that we're working. We're the person entertaining and they're going out for entertainment. And so the time that you feel most free without any pressure, you can allow yourself not to think about the gig is in the mornings until lunchtime. So I started again with my little love heart list, doing a lot of research about breakfast. And then I just realized, I think I'm a breakfasty person. I think I absolutely love eggs of any sort.
Yeah.
And then I started finding it. I thought, I'm going to find the best eggs Benedict. And then my friend's a chef, so I regularly send him, I don't print it anywhere, I just send him my breakfast reviews.
All right.
Ambience, attitude. Do you know, like, I kind of go, oh, they were grumpy this morning. Do you know, I'll send him, he'll say he wants photographs of the eggs Benedict. It's usually eggs Benedict. That's usually
so where would you recommend in Edinburgh for eggs Benedict?
Weirdly, I would recommend, I don't know why I said weirdly, but I think it's because it's been there forever. There's a place on Broughton Street called the Olive Branch.
All right.
And they've consistently done a beautiful Eggs Benedict for years on a muffin. I don't know what they do to that sauce. I don't know if it's a homemade hollandaise. There'll be some chef who's better than that. I said, well, my goodness, we do a homemade hollandaise. I can't believe you advertise that. But whatever they do, I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Breakfast, there's a new place. Let's all go together.
Yeah.
There's the thing I get most excited about, and this is why I chose this, because your wonder should make you feel the way I'm feeling right now. You should be joyous and you should want to share. And there's a new place at the very top of Leith Street in Edinburgh called Noon. Now, they've just opened in this building, a beautiful building. And I don't remember ever noticing that building before, but my God, I don't know who they are, but my God, they specialise in fantastic breakfasts.
Yes.
So I've been there. If you go there, I'll be next to you. I'm obsessed with that place.
Noon, all right.
So I love finding new places for breakfast. And I like doing that all over the world. And I have to say the place, I don't know if there's any Australians in, but the Australians, I think, the best place I've ever been for breakfast in my life. Because I think they specialise in breakfast and they don't get away with having a mediocre breakfast. The ingredients are beautiful. Mm. They seem to really change it up. They're really creative and imaginative. I think they treat it as like it's an evening restaurant.
Yeah.
So their breakfasts are the ones that I've been most blown away with. And of course, the reason I would know that is because that's more likely where I would be for a 3-week festival. So that would be a lot of breakfasts, you know. Yeah. So my knowledge of breakfast is mainly in a place that I'm there for quite a while. I remember in Kuala Lumpur, I used to do a gig for the Scottish Society of Kuala Lumpur. They're called the St. Andrews Selangor Society. And on the way back from Australia, if anyone knows you're in Australia and you're working, you're doing the festivals, they say, oh, could you come over and host a burn supper or something?
All right.
And that's good fun. It's, you know, it's a kind of half Scottish expats and a half Malaysian audience. It's lovely.
Yeah.
And they would put us up in something like, I don't know, some hotel, but the hotel was much more international breakfast-wise. I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
Because there were people from all over the world and you started to learn what they had for breakfast, but they weren't on our palate.
No.
They were too savoury for me in the mornings.
Or even sort of like Dutch or German will have cheese and things.
Yeah, exactly.
We eat cheese the rest of the day, but what you think, well, cheese is a bit weird for
breakfast. Oh, it's all wrong, cheese and ham in the morning. Yeah. No, and scrambled eggs. Folded eggs. I've since learned about that. Someone folded their eggs in front of me recently. Right. I think it's a slightly less scrambled eggs. It's moist and gorgeous. So.
You still go for it, yeah.
I still go for it. I love
The other thing, maybe this makes me a bit of a loner, but I'm not a loner, but, you know, I find it, you know, I don't really want to go out for lunch or dinner on my own, but breakfast, I'm quite happy to go
I
into.
I totally agree with you. You feel much more comfortable.
Yeah, it seems reasonable.
And I love it when I get it right. I was in Nottingham a few weeks ago, and I think the place was called Toast or something, and I looked at it online, I was like, this, I love the way it looked, I love the menu, I could tell by the sound of it, I thought, oh, they're using rose harissa, excuse us. And then I met this couple standing outside, and if there's a queue outside, that's always a good sign.
Yes.
And this couple said, how did you know about this place if you're not from here? And I said, it's just a little bit of research, love heart list.
Yeah.
So, and they said, well, you chose really well, this is one of the nicest places in Nottingham, so...
Craig, we've got to keep moving.
Keep going, my goodness.
We're going to overrun.
I told you a Scotsman would talk too much.
When is that? I've never heard the theory that Scotsmen talk too much.
Oh, really?
I know a lot of Scotsmen.
We absolutely love the sound of our own voice.
He didn't talk too much.
Maybe it was me. Maybe it's me specifically. I just talk too much.
I'm not, you know, I'm sure there's some Scotsmen here, but it can be quite dour. And,
I'm not one of those. I'm not one of those.
Yes. Okay. Last one on your list. Last wonder. And it's dancing.
I know. That sounds like a really gay choice. But people always think I'm on drugs. And I never am. And I'm always the last person. Do you know, I remember going to Sitges in Spain and... Do you know, me and my friend were dancing till like 4 a.m. and somebody was saying, Mike, what have you taken? And I said, it's called life. And I just think I think I'm at my most euphoric when I'm dancing. I think it's the most I ever let go. I don't know if there's anything in when you're physically letting go as much as that. I don't know, maybe it's just really good for you. Maybe you let go of more than you realize. Maybe it's really good for all your stress. But I find myself, I lose myself when I'm dancing. I think I get such joy from dancing. And I don't know if anyone's seen me, but I dance on stage. I come on dancing on stage. And that's partly to disarm the audience a wee bit, you know, so that they kind of go, oh, God, I think you might be homosexual. Just in case anyone doesn't know what they've come to see, it really gives you a flavour immediately.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it seems to make people smile. There's something quite fun about watching somebody really go for it on a dance floor. So I think I find it's where I let go the most.
So this dancing, you're doing it to 4 a.m. It's not formal ballroom dancing or actually,
can you imagine?
Well, hang on, you should be on Strictly Come Dancing.
I probably should. I would love to do it.
Maybe you're going to be either announcing them.
Well, you never
gradually,
know.
You might be the last.
Maybe I've kept it a secret. I hardly think so. But
I just heard today Tony Adams, who's used as a footballer, he's on Strictly the next series, and you must be a better dancer than he is.
Well, I love the fact you think a gay man would know anything about a footballer.
I'm talking to you. I'm involving the audience.
But anyway, I do think I really take my hat off to the people on Strictly, because that looks particularly difficult, because it's very, very, very choreographed, and it's a lot of hard work.
And you're criticised immediately.
Yeah, but I think it's funny, because I think Strictly would be really hard. I think what I'm talking about is the dancing where it's totally up to you. It's free.
Yeah, yeah.
You do whatever you want to do. But I mean, I think that's the most excited I ever get. Well, not always. The most excited I get is on a dance floor. Yeah. I think is the most I express myself.
And since you're in a kilt, do you do Scottish country dancing or
No.
Like
I was
do you
in
Burns Night Suppers. Do you did it break into a bit of a Kaylee afterwards?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I was at a wedding a few weeks ago, and yes, I did do all the Kaylee dancing in the kilt. But I mean, I love doing Latino in a kilt because it's such a quick spin. I was doing this in a really posh restaurant in Edinburgh called CC Blooms. It's a gay bar, and I was dancing the other night.
Well, everyone seemed to do it anyway.
I was surprised.
Yeah.
I was very surprised. It says a lot about your audience. But yeah, I was dancing the other night, and I was just thinking, this is so much fun, like, because the kilt has this lovely movement about it. So I think a kilt lends itself to dancing.
Yes. Right. Well, yes, very good.
I think you've come round to my wonders.
I've come round to a lot of them. Well, look, we've got to the end of your wonders, and I've got to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful as you described it on the podcast. And strangely enough, and I didn't expect this to be the one, I think, so I was very tempted by Google Maps, because I think I'm going to be inspired to go and use it to keep a note of good places and things which I've never done before. And I like singing's impressive, planes good. Listener, not so much, but going out for breakfast. I think you got me anyway, and I think many people in the room that you've inspired us to think that is a rather jolly thing to do.
We'll do that. I'll take you to noon.
Take me to noon. That'd be well. I should take you. So thank you for. I've got one. I've got another story about one called Etoile, but I can take you there as well. But anyway, so I wonder if we can give Craig Hill a big round of applause for joining us.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.